Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street grilled again, coal mine tragedy, and hot leaked videotape out of Iraq this week. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission opened hearings in Washington. There were Wall Street denials and apologies. Here's former Citigroup CEO Charles Prince.
I'm sorry for the millions of people, average Americans, who have lost their homes. And I'm sorry that our management team, starting with me, like so many others, could not see the unprecedented market collapse that lay before us.
West Virginia and the country grieving and waiting for news from the Upper Big Branch mine. Here's Regina Lilly, a miner's cousin.
It's devastating to want answers and to want your loved one brought out and your family brought out, and you can't get that.
And controversy over a leaked video showing civilians in Baghdad, including Reuters journalists, taken down by airborne U.S. gunners.
Light them all up.
Traffic 260.
Come on, fire!
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining me now from Washington is Jennifer Rubin, contributing editor at Commentary Magazine. She writes Commentary's Contentions blog. Jennifer, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Tom.
With us from New York, Michael Crowley, senior editor at The New Republic. Michael, welcome back as well.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jennifer, and Michael.
Let's go right to the tape of the American and Russian leaders on nuclear weapons. Here's President Obama speaking in Prague yesterday, said the newly signed nuclear arms control treaty between the U.S. and Russia was an important demonstration of good relations between the two countries.
When the United States and Russia are not able to work together on big issues, it's not good for either of our nations, nor is it good for the world. Together, we've stopped that drift and proven the benefits of cooperation. Today is an important milestone for nuclear security and nonproliferation and for U.S.-Russia relations.
And here's President Medvedev, also in Prague, calling the new arms treaty a truly historic event. Here he is speaking through a translator.
What matters most is that this is a win-win situation. No one stands to lose from this agreement. I believe that this is a typical feature of our cooperation. Both parties have won, and taking into account this victory of ours, the entire world community has won.
Michael Crowley, let me come first to you. What matters about this new nuclear agreement? What doesn't matter, and what are its prospects for ratification in the U.S. Senate?
Well, I think I don't want to minimize it too much, but I think that the symbolism in some ways is the most important part in two senses. One is that I really think that at the crux of Barack Obama's foreign policy doctrine right now is this vision of denuclearizing the world. And he understands that in his lifetime, we're not going to eradicate all nuclear weapons on the planet. But he is doing everything he can to demonstrate that the trend should be toward reducing stockpiles in the world and dissuading people from wanting to build more nuclear weapons. And the more he can demonstrate that America is making a good faith effort to do that through agreements like this one, the more credibility he has. Quickly, the second point is it shows that the attempt to reset relations with Russia has really worked. It was not clear in the early months of Obama's presidency whether we were really going to be able to pull off a thaw with relations which had gotten worse. And it really looks like there is a spirit of cooperation and a decent relationship. That said, the final point I would make is that it's nice to see fewer weapons. The stockpiles the two countries have are still, unfortunately enough, to lay waste to the entire Earth a couple times over, at least, if I'm not mistaken. So there's still quite a long ways to go. But I think that the symbolism is not hollow here.
We'll come back to how far the thaw with Russia's actually gone. Jennifer Rubin, do you see 8 Republican votes in the U.S. Senate? That's what it would take at this point to ratify the treaty.
I think it's problematic at this point. You heard yesterday from Senator Kyle and Senator McCain. You also heard a very cautious statement from Senator Joe Lieberman saying they really need to see what's in this. And one aspect that they're concerned about is whether there is a trigger that allows Russia to withdraw from the treaty if we pursue our missile defense. And they feel that that would be an impediment to moving ahead on what they see as a critical part of our national security. So I think it's going to be some tough going in the United States Senate. I would disagree with Michael on a couple points. One being that I think that this vision of a denuclearized world is sort of bizarre at the very moment that the Iranians are moving forward, and we seem to be out of effective means of stopping them. So on one hand, you have this nice paper agreement with the Russians, which I think he rightly says the reductions are small, the way we count the missiles is limited, it may not get through the United States Senate. And on the other hand, you have these rogue states running around compiling a nuclear program. And engagement has not worked. The sanctions that they are talking about are very limited. And if there is some spirit of cooperation, it's so minimal, I'm not sure how effective it's going to be. At the same press conference, the Russians let it be known that they're talking about smart sanctions, which is a buzzword for very, very limited sanctions, ones which are unable and unlikely to be effective. And then, of course, the Obama administration has essentially taken military force off the table. So you have this great dichotomy, this great divergence between the rhetoric and this nice TV moment and what's actually going on in the world, which is probably our greatest national security threat in a generation.
Jack Beatty, let me come to you on that. The vision of a denuclearized world, bizarre at this moment or kind of an essential table setting to get the world behind the U.S. when it comes to Iran, maybe North Korea?
Well, I agree with Jennifer that there is an irony here as these two countries seem to, well, North Korea already there and Iran moving there. However, you know, for years people have said that there's a kind of contagion of goodwill or of example in this nuclear business, that if you want countries that are on the brink not to go over the brink, and I don't know other than those two which they would be, you need to do things on your side that shows that show that the superpowers are interested in scaling things down. And so I think this does send that kind of example. I regret that the president did not carry through on the promise he made in the campaign to reduce the threat of accidental or inadvertent nuclear launch. He made a big deal of that. He criticized the Bush administration for that. And yet this treaty will leave the 2,000 Russian and American nuclear warheads ready to launch just on a few minutes' notice. And that's scary, and that really doesn't correspond to the threat vis-a-vis Russia. On the other hand, it raises the risk of inadvertent use.
This all comes in the same week when the United States is announcing a new nuclear posture, committing explicitly to not using nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states in compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, even if they attack the United States with biological or chemical weapons or launched a big cyber attack, but with loopholes. Here's Secretary of Defense Robert Gates explaining that updated nuclear posture review, what he calls the NPR here, and how it would affect the country's nuclear weapons strategy.
The NPR includes significant changes to the U.S. nuclear posture. New declaratory policies remove some of the calculated ambiguity in previous U.S. declaratory policy. If a non-nuclear weapons state is in compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and its obligations, the U.S. pledges not to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against it.
Michael Crowley, how big a change is this? It sounds big on the surface. He's taking heat from Republicans on this front. What do you see in the change of nuclear posture, the NPR?
Well, again, I hate to repeat myself. I think what we largely have here is symbolism. And it's of the same vein where Barack Obama is trying to change the way in which the world talks about nuclear weapons and the world perceives the United States to be thinking about nuclear weapons. But I think that in a case like this, there's only so much you can read into a doctrine and what it would mean in a worst-case scenario. So, for instance, if an NPT adherent country were to use biological weapons against the United States, you know, does the existence of this new posture mean that we would rule out a nuclear retaliation? You know, I think probably not. That said, was it ever entirely credible that we would detonate a nuclear bomb and kill hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in response to attack like that? Maybe not. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that I think we're somewhat in the realm of the theoretical. What to me is most significant is, again, the message that Obama is trying to send, and also the way in which the quote that the provision that Secretary Gates just described in the quote you played is really a way, I think, of singling out Iran and North Korea and saying it's a way of trying to further marginalize these states. I actually think that there's a way in which that could backfire, because it, to the degree that those states want their nuclear weapons to defend themselves against what they perceive as the United States that, you know, may be interested in toppling their regimes or taking them out, this actually gives them more of an incentive to maintain their own deterrent capability. So, you know, I'm not sure that the logic plays out there the way the administration wants it to, but that said, I think that's a That's actually kind of a marginal thing in the larger effort to keep those countries from getting or retaining the bomb. And I just very quickly want to respond to what Jennifer said, which is that, yes, at a time when these countries are building nuclear weapons, it doesn't seem realistic for the rest of the world to disarm. But I just think that it is a useful way to try to bring world opinion around to America's side as we try to assemble an international coalition, particularly against Iran, to demonstrate that we are not, in the view of some people, being hypocritical by sitting on these massive arsenals and feeling like we don't have to do anything and we can tell other people what to do. I think there is a real symbolic benefit there.
Let's get a caller right here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. I just seems to me that the on the subject of the nuclear proposals this week, I don't think you can discuss this really without addressing the fact that Israel has over 100 nuclear weapons, and Netanyahu refused to attend next week's conference on this. It seems to me that if we're really going to have any leverage over emerging nuclear powers such as Iran, we can't continue to play this charade and pretend that Israel does not have weapons. They need to be brought on board and sign the nuclear non-proliferation agreement and allow inspectors in, because that's what it entails, to monitor their stores of nukes.
Mark, thanks for your call. Jennifer Rubin, what do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu's decision not to attend the conference on nuclear security in Washington?
Well, I think the caller articulated exactly why he's not showing up, because this was going to turn into a feeding frenzy, apparently, to bludgeon Israel. And I think it's a sad statement on the state of U.S.-Israeli relations that the Israeli prime minister could not rely on the United States president to keep this on track and to prevent that from happening. I think this is a really the nadir of U.S.-Israeli relations. Getting back to a couple of points that my fellow commentators made, I would like to think that this contagion of goodwill is going to work. But the history of the last several decades suggests that nothing of the kind ever occurs.
On nuclear proliferation.
Yes. The history of arms control between the United States, previously the Soviet Union, now Russia, did not keep Pakistan from going nuclear, did not prevent India from going nuclear, did not prevent the Iranians from pursuing their own program. There's just no evidence that this works. These people are not motivated by the example that the West sets, and I think this is just the sort of naive, you know, thinking that pervades the administration. As far as the rest of the world getting on board, the problem is that the Chinese and the Russians are still not willing to enact very serious sanctions. We're going to get these watered down, this sort of gruel that is not going to be effective. To Michael's point, the treaty says exactly what he said that probably wouldn't occur, namely that if an NPT signatory attacks us with either chemical or biological weapons, well, we would not use nuclear force. Now, maybe the treaty is silly and it doesn't mean what it says, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that. I think if you have a million dead Americans on the streets, no president is going to take anything off the table. But then it's silliness, and then we are eroding our credibility by saying silly statements.
I think you're talking not about the treaty, but the posture review there.
Yes, I'm sorry. Excuse me. The nuclear posture review, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because it specifically says exactly that if you are an NPT signatory, and then we'll have, what, a fight between lawyers as to whether someone's a signatory or not? This is, you know, sort of silliness on stilts. But if we're attacked by a magnetic pulse or a biological weapon or a chemical weapon, that we would not use nuclear force. There's good reason for maintaining ambiguity. It keeps people in line. It acts as a deterrence. And this has been a bipartisan policy, you know, for quite some time right now. So I think this is part of this otherworldliness that is really really very counterproductive at a time where we're facing some very, very serious threats.
So I'm looking at analysis here of the new posture from Peter Feaver, who now at Duke he was with the Bush and Clinton administration, saying it doesn't really, when you get into the fine print, doesn't really change where we are. But this argument about naive versus visionary will certainly go on. Let's talk about ambiguity. I want to get to Afghanistan and the president there, Hamid Karzai. Multiple reports, Associated Press and others, him talking with Afghan lawmakers and threatening to actually go over to the Taliban, join the Taliban, if the pressure wasn't taken off by the West, including the U.S., for him to end corruption and fraud. On Wednesday, his spokesman, Waheed Omar, strenuously denied that Karzai had made that comment.
That was a, I think, a funny thing in the media, and we really, we were shocked to see such kind of a comment in the media.
And here is President Obama's press secretary, Robert Gibbs, asked about the same comments and continuing accusations that the UN and international, his, Karzai's accusation that the UN and international community had interfered, that they had interfered with last year's Afghan elections. Here's Gibbs' response.
They're troubling. They're confusing. They've been investigated and they've been found to be untruthful. So whether there's some domestic political benefit that he's trying to gain, I can't say.
Jack, what do you see going on in this quite amazing back and forth with Hamid Karzai?
Well, I think Mr. Karzai has shrewdly sized up Barack Obama's dilemma. I think that Obama needs him more, in a strange way, more than he needs Obama. He has calculated rightly that the political component in the decision to escalate in Afghanistan is very high. The president does not want to go to a country in 2012 as the man who, quote, lost Afghanistan. And that to keep our presence there, we're willing to do pretty much anything in order to preserve that political chit for the president. Anything, including listening to a stream of absurdities from the Afghan president. And, of course, the linchpin of the strategy is good, accountable governance in Afghanistan is what will, you know, turn the tide there. And on that side, the side of corruption and good governance, there's no sign of progress with Mr. Karzai.
Michael Crowley, what do you see going on in Afghanistan?
Well, I think Jack put it very well. I would say that Karzai clearly has Obama over a barrel here. One can hope, I think to some degree you can allow for a bit of demagoguery for a leader like Karzai to be bashing the U.S. to appear domestically like he is not simply a puppet. And I don't take very seriously the idea, even if he said it, you know, maybe as sort of a joke or some sort of absurd rhetorical flight of fancy, I don't take very seriously the idea that he's going to join the Taliban. But, you know, he has long been very strenuously critical of civilian casualties incurred by American airstrikes. And I think, you know, to some degree, some of that is understandable. You know, what you have to do is judge him by results. Now, unfortunately, I wish I could turn the corner and say the results have been great. The results have not been great. Corruption does not seem to be improving, and that is just a fundamental thing we have to fix. But I would pay more attention to what's happening. He did remove two people from the Election Oversight Commission, two of his kind of henchmen who we did not want there. And I would say that would be a sign that, you know, he is responding somewhat to pressure. I would just want to add on this point, I guess the big picture, is that if you talk to people who specialize in counterinsurgency doctrine, people who are sort of academic about this, how do you fight and win a counterinsurgency? Frequently, what they will tell you, the most important principle of counterinsurgency, successful counterinsurgency, is that it requires a capable, competent partner in the local government in the country where you're trying to put down the insurgency. So fundamentally, it's extremely troubling if we don't feel that we can trust Karzai, because that, if you talk to the people who know this stuff, they say that that is essentially the first principle of doing this. And so I don't see how we can be successful as long as it carries on like this.
If that's a first principle, if that's required, we are in trouble. Jennifer, I'll come to you, but first a call from East Hampton, New York. Ned, you're on the air, Ned. Or Neil, sorry, Neil.
Yeah. This is basically Vietnam Redux. From day one in Afghanistan, we never had a partner. The whole concept was never properly developed. We didn't build the government. We didn't build up the military. We didn't build up the police. Basically, it's a process It's an idiot box mind game that we play there, and we just keep yanking ourselves all the time. It's just masturbatory and goes nowhere. There's no place for it to go.
Neil, let us pick it up. Jennifer, an idiot box, Vietnam Redux, no partner. What do you say?
Well, things certainly don't seem to be going swimmingly right now. And I think this is somewhat reminiscent of what happened, of course, during Iraq, in which we were presented with a problematic leader, a prime minister. There were allegations of corruption, of partisan and sectarian violence there. And we worked with him quietly. There was a great deal of bashing of him here in the United States and among members of Congress, but the Bush administration quietly worked and strenuously worked with him. It is unfortunate that this fight with Karzai has gone on in public round after public round. He is a problematic figure, to be sure. He has many faults, but he's the only guy in town. And it really is beyond me why the Obama administration would want to engage him publicly, whether he says these outlandish things or not, to up the ante and to continue the public debate back and forth, I think serves neither of our interests. This is somewhat reminiscent of the spat we've had with Israel, in which it seems sort of mind-boggling that these public spats with allies take center stage, conveying a message to our opponents that there is a dissension. He is a problematic character. We're going to have to work with him, and I think Michael is correct that you need to have an effective domestic authority to assure the population that they'll have a alternative to the violence and to the Taliban. But this is not the way to go about it, and I think we do have an essential policy that has proven effective. I think a counterinsurgency strategy is ultimately the only success we have. And what is the alternative? To abandon Afghanistan and then in turn Pakistan to the Taliban and to al-Qaeda? The president has made clear that that's not our policy, that he believes that this is essential to our national security. Yep. So we're going to have to get our act together.
And yet, when there is dissension at some point, it's got to be addressed. Let me turn to another front, if I may. On Monday, the whistleblower website WikiLeaks released a video showing an American helicopter shooting at a group of men, including journalists, in Baghdad. This was in 2007. Here's some of that tape after the first attack, and this is from a U.S. gunship. A van comes to pick up wounded survivors. In this clip, the helicopter pilots ask for permission to fire on the van.
Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage. I'm picking up the wounded. Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
Come on, let us shoot. And there's been a lot of controversy over what we're looking at here. It doesn't look good. Alex in Worcester, Massachusetts, what do you think about this tape, Alex?
Hello, Tom. I think that it's slightly being distorted as being described as shooting of innocent Iraqi civilians. If you look at the tape, even the WikiLeaks tape, around, I want to say, 349, 340, you'll see the cameramen with their cameras, but then you'll also see other men with RPGs and AK-47s. And while I'm sorry that the cameraman and the reporters got killed, they probably should not have been hanging out with people with AK-47s and RPGs.
How does a journalist not hang out with people with AK-47s in a war zone? I mean, isn't that what happens? Isn't that, you know what I mean?
They can. Oh, no, it's fine. They can do that. But then they can't really bitch and complain when they get killed by an Apache gunship.
Well,
I mean, if you want to hang out with essentially terrorists and insurgents, there is an inherent risk that goes on. And just because they do have a camera or because they are journalists and they claim to be neutral, that doesn't necessarily provide them with some sort of magic talisman to get away from it.
Alex, we've got it. On the other hand, you know, who knows from the air necessarily if they're terrorists or insurgents. A lot of people were carrying weapons in Baghdad at that time. Jack, what did you see in this video, this incident?
Well, as some people have pointed out, this attack came within the rules of engagement. This wasn't an aberration in the sense that people were just acting on their own without checking that this was within their writ. And that's the trouble, isn't it? That, you know, when you invade other countries, when you play this international game, this is what happens. You wind up giving, again and again, civilians a kill. I mean, recently, General McChrystal said it was amazing how many times civilians were being killed by us in by the Allies in Afghanistan. And just this week in Afghanistan, it came out that the February raid by special forces on a village, which resulted in several people being killed, had killed two women, both pregnant, one the mother of 10. And we had denied it, and now it's come out that, in fact, our people did it, and there's some charges that we tried to cover it up by digging the bullets out of the wall, by even, according to the London Times, digging the bullets out of the dead women. And the point is, this kind of thing, so we're fighting a local insurgency in Afghanistan, and this suddenly becomes an internet, through the publicity given this sort of horror, that goes worldwide into the what one British general calls the insurgent archipelago behind the lines. And that's where terrorism comes.
I have to say right here, I've just got an AP report coming over the wires. This is a bit of a turn, but this is big, saying that Justice John Paul Stevens, leader of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court, will retire this summer. Jack, your first response.
Well, a notable career. I mean, he was appointed by President Ford, and really, you know, when people talk about growing on the court, at least from my point of view, he's grown on the court. I can remember the phrasing of some of his dissents, and they have been in recent years. And now, what's going to happen with his replacement? There's the Republicans have threatened to filibuster. That's happened only once with the Abe Fortas case, that a Supreme Court justice nominee has been filibustered. And it is not a pivotal vote. So the even the filibuster argument, which would apply if a conservative were retiring, because that could upset the balance, it doesn't seem to be, it isn't there for this filibuster argument. But it's going to be a long, hot summer.
Jennifer, what do you see coming with John Paul Stevens' retirement? More shift in the court, status quo, a big fight?
I think I would agree with Jack. He is likely to be replaced by another so-called liberal justice. The question is whether the president chooses to make a rather symbolic political choice, the way he did with Sonia Sotomayor, or whether he goes with an academic type, a highly respected but nevertheless liberal justice, someone like Diane Wood, who was up for consideration last time, or our current Solicitor General, Elena Kagan. So I think it is going to be a little bit of a fight. Frankly, I don't know that it's going to be a huge fight. I think the other issues that are predominating are the ones that are going to take us through the election season, the president's passage of his health care bill, the economy, continued high unemployment. I think the Republicans tend to like these sorts of fights because they tend to put them on the offensive with respect to issues like abortion and guns, which are their constituent groups. But I would be surprised unless the president chooses a very off-the-wall choice or someone who's clearly not qualified, which I don't imagine he would do, that we would actually have a filibuster. They haven't announced that they have a filibuster, by the way. There was simply one senator who indicated that that was not out of the realm of possibility.
Michael Crowley, we've just got 20 seconds before the break. Do we do anything without a big fight in Washington these days?
Yeah, nothing goes terribly smoothly right now. I did notice Senator Kyle sometime in the last couple days, senior Senate Republican, saying he did not think there would be a filibuster. And I think it's in the interest of both parties to really make their case as best they can on issues like health care and the economy. Republicans go nuclear on this at their own risk. There are things that people are quite concerned about now, more than replacing one liberal with another.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Duke won the NCAA College Basketball Championship Monday night, 61-59. Tiny Butler University playing Cinderella almost pulled it out.
At midcourt, launches the shot. Oh, it almost went in! Almost went in, and Duke is the king of the dance, 2010.
Early Apple iPod buyers were raving this week. MSNBC took its cameras around the country.
They make amazing products, and this especially is something that I had to add.
I describe it as Oscars for nerds, and I really think it is.
And a furious uprising in Kyrgyzstan, mayhem in the streets, and a change of government. Here's Russian TV outlet RTR with the sound of rebellion.
Remember,
Wow, that is fierce in Kyrgyzstan. Let's get a call from Dothan, Alabama, and Roscoe. Roscoe, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question about, or a comment about this mine disaster in West Virginia.
Yes.
Is there a reason that they cannot force that company to not operate in West Virginia, or to not operate until they come in compliance with all their safety measures?
You mean just shut down all West Virginia coal mining operation?
No, that particular company, that Massey outfit.
Yeah, until they're in compliance. We'll look at
until
that.
They're in compliance.
Yep, Roscoe, thank you very much for that call, and let's get one more on the coal mine. Upper Big Branch, Robbins, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air, Terry.
Yes, I kind of changed my comment because it was not as understandable. Don Blankenship, the owners of the mine, and every supervisor that has faked any safety information should have been the first ones down in that mine with the worst safety equipment that they supply to their employees. They should be doing the rescue.
Put them right out there in danger. The others were clearly in danger. Terry, thank you for your call. Now, the news we're hearing this morning is that there's been smoke down there, and they've pulled back from a lot of this effort to get in and see what's going on. A couple of comments we've got here on tape. Here from Christian Beverly, wife of a coal miner, saying today that the accident's a big blow to the whole area and criticizing Massey Energy, the owner of the mine.
There was a lot lost up there. A lot of families lost a lot. And my opinion, Massey does not care.
Here's Don Blankenship, CEO of Massey Energy, which owns the mine, rejecting accusations that the mine, the owners, ignored workers' safety in favor of profit. The mine was cited for 458 safety violations in 2009, paid nearly $900,000 in fines that year. Here's Blankenship, the CEO.
It's not possible to put production ahead of safety because you can't be productive if you're not safe.
Jack, here we've seen all week the way these regulations get danced around. A citation is issued. It's protested by the owners, and it seems to hang up right there. You hear a caller saying shut down all their mining until they've got full compliance everywhere. On the other hand, the coal's got a role. At least that's what Massey says.
Again and again, you see this pattern of inspectors will say something and then they'd be overruled. In 2006, the Arakoma mine, Massey mine, just days before that incident there was a fire. A mine inspector ordered the place to be, that section of the mine to be closed down. He was overruled by his superior. And, you know, Mr. Blankenship, he really shows the fatal grip here of money on politics. I mean, he is famously, he funded a campaign against to elect a judge in West Virginia who was litigating a case that might have been $50 million of his was at stake, and he paid $3 million and got his judge. One of his former CEOs was named the commissioner of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission by President Bush in 2003. Another man from his board was put in charge of mine safety in 2006, both rejected by the Senate, one given a recess appointment. He's been a large giver over the years to both parties, predominantly the Republicans. He's a power in that state, an oligarch, and with the grip of money on politics and on appointments, he's essentially been allowed to run a very dangerous business.
Jennifer, how far would you go in putting the heat, the pressure on Massey Energy? How far can we go under the law when you've got these deaths, a very, very troubling record? On the other hand, there's a system.
Well, I think there's going to be obviously a massive investigation. There will probably be a criminal investigation. There will certainly be a regulatory investigation. And there will be both the houses of Congress that no doubt want to take a look at this. And it is a good question why the record is allowed to go along this far. You have two very powerful senators from West Virginia, Senator Rockefeller and Senator Byrd. And what do they have to say about this? And why aren't they at the forefront championing a more stringent regulatory regime. I think, obviously, money in politics and the power of the industry has something to do with that, and someone should put a microphone in front of those senators' faces and ask them about it. So I think we're at the beginning, certainly probably not to be resolved anytime soon, but I think the entire regulatory regime is going to be examined, and I think there's going to be some special prosecutors or district attorneys who are going to be involved as well.
A lot of grief there this week, a lot of anger, and way too many deaths. Brattleboro, Vermont. Jerry, you're on the air, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Look, I have actually two quick questions. Mm-hmm. I was totally appalled by the Charles Prince sorry or apology made on Capitol Hill. It is totally unacceptable, and I think for them to just accept a sorry is unacceptable.
This is the former CEO of Citicorp who was getting grilled and apologizing, but then doing a lot of defending as well.
Right. No, to me, it was a disgrace. Secondly, this addresses to Jennifer Rubin, and I think Netanyahu is a little bit of a saber rattler. And secondly, we should stop the $2 billion in aid to Israel if they don't quit not building settlements in what is Palestine. And to me, that's the root of all our problems in the Middle East, but no one, frankly, wants to face it. And I'd like to hear our response.
Jerry, we'll do that. Will you let me pick up first the Wall Street element, then we'll come to Israel. Here's some tape from those hearings. Robert Rubin, another Citigroup, this is a former senior advisor, also former U.S. Treasury Secretary, testifying yesterday before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, where you saw Charles Prince at his side. He said it was difficult to see the whole crisis coming.
Almost all of us, including me, who were involved in the financial system, that is to say, financial firms, regulators, rating agencies, analysts, and commentators missed the powerful combination of factors that led to this crisis.
Missed it. He was questioned, with the panel saying, "How could you? This is your job. How could you miss this? This is what you're supposed to be responsible to see." Bankers were the only ones who took heat. Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, here he was before the same commission, and commission chair Phil Angelides had this exchange about Greenspan's failings during his tenure. Here's Greenspan first.
In the business I was in, I was right 70% of the time, but I was wrong 30% of the time. And there are an awful lot of mistakes in 21 years. So I'm not sure what good it
is. Would you put this in the 30% category?
I'm sorry?
Would you put this in the 30?
I don't know. Certainly part of it.
A lot of arguing over culpability, apologies, and defense. Michael Crowley, you hear our caller saying completely unsatisfied with Charles Prince's apology there, which came at the top of testimony that did a lot of defending as well. What do you see going on here, Michael?
Well, part of what I see is kind of an apology that seems like something more than it is. I mean, it's an apology, but that comes with an explanation that I think doesn't completely hold water. I mean, there were people who were warning that we were in an economic bubble well before the crash, and they weren't just a bunch of marginal outliers. And at the same time, this institution took on an enormous amount of risk. And I think that, to just say I was massively leveraged and I had no idea that this was going to go wrong on me just doesn't wash. These CEOs had a responsibility not to get over-leveraged, not to assume too much risk. And again, as I said, there were people who were warning that that we could be in a pretty major financial and economic bubble, and they should have responded by dialing back their risk. So I think it's a little bit of a bogus apology, but I think the most important thing really is what happens now. And so the question is whether we will get real financial and regulatory reform that prevents something like this from happening again, whether the influence of Wall Street money in Washington allows something substantive to happen that has teeth, and whether the current CEOs of big Wall Street banks are going to have learned some lessons and try to work with the Congress and accept changes to the law that are good for the national interest and for the American economy and not just good for their profit margins. And I have to say I've seen a lot of evidence recently that Wall Street doesn't really care that much, doesn't think that there need to be real changes, that there was a kind of 500-year flood situation here, and there's not that much to be learned from it. So that's what troubles me the most, I suppose.
We've got a lot to say on that front, but a lot more news to hit in this hour. I'm going to put a pause on that one. Jennifer, there's a direct question to you from our caller, Jerry, saying, we should stop the, $2 billion in U.S. aid to Israel until Israeli policy on the West Bank, the territories, settlements changes. What do you say, Jennifer?
Well, many of Israel's opponents and enemies would be happy to see that happen. But in fact, Israel has repeatedly at Camp David with Prime Minister Olmert, and as he departed, made repeated offers of land for peace, and they've been rejected. The central problem is not territorial. The United States, before Barack Obama decided to change the policy, was to put off settlements and borders and Jerusalem for a final status negotiation. The central problem is that the Israelis face an Arab world and a Palestinian group that does not recognize it, that has not forsworn violence, and that is really not capable, I think, at this point in making a peace deal. And I think we've seen that for all the to-ing and fro-ing and for the, I think, staged confrontation with Israel, the central dilemma here is that you have a divided Palestinian entity between Hamas and Fatah, and you have no one on their side who is willing to or is capable at this point, lacking sufficient Palestinian institutions to develop a civil society that could make a peace deal and then enforce a peace deal. I would commend the reader to the remarks that Tony Blair made at the APEC conference, which I thought were quite interesting and quite thoughtful, in which he said, we can have paper agreements, we can have conferences, but what we need is a change in mindset, and what we need is a institution and a civil society to grow up on the Palestinian side. So it would be nice to think that simply stopping a settlement building would bring peace in our time, but I think that's foolish, and it's been disproved by history.
Michael Crowley, we've got way too much to get to linger on this, but in very brief, a staged confrontation with Israel here, Israel and Washington, or a real standoff right now?
Well, I think there's some of both. I mean, I look, it's hard for me to know what Barack Obama is really thinking here, but I think it is possible that his analysis of the situation is that the United States is perceived as being an apologist for Israel, and that creating a little bit of a distance and being seen as a little bit more of an arbiter in the region than an ally of Israel would make it easier for that change of mindset in the Arab world to happen, which I completely agree is necessary. There does have to be a change of mindset. I don't know if that is his rationale, but I would say that that's in a way the most sort of charitable thing you can say about the way he's been going about this.
I want to get this tape from the Southern Republican Leadership Conference in New Orleans yesterday. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, quite possibly a presidential candidate upcoming. He said it depends on God, and I'm not sure what else. But here he is calling President Obama the most radical, I think the most, well, he called him the most radical president in history, a secular socialist machine.
I believe the radicalism of this administration and the incompetence of this administration make it possible to have a decisive choice for every American, and we need to make sure it's a choice of two positive versions, not Obama versus anti-Obama, but America versus a secular socialist machine.
Sir Jack, what do you say to Newt?
He is the sultan of political hyperbole. I mean, no one compares with him. On this program several years ago, at the time of the Israeli incursion into Lebanon, he said, this is the beginning of World War III. No one tops him in that realm. This week also, he spoke about new death panels, and he said that the GOP should campaign against this non-existent IRS health Gestapo, those mythical 16,000 agents who are going to, you know, comb your tax returns to make sure you've purchased insurance. In fact, the IRS has 13,000 investigators on their payroll now, and this would be this 16,000. It's a totally made-up number. So will Mr. Gingrich run for president? I don't know. I can't see that campaign prospering just because he's given so many hostages to fortune over the years with his incontinent expressions.
Jennifer, I found the quote here. He called President Obama the most radical president in American history, saying he's now thrown down the gauntlet to the American people. I mean, they elected him. What about that most radical tag? Does that really fit? Jennifer?
I think he certainly is the most liberal president we've had. I think in foreign policy, he has made quite a point of departing from past bipartisan policies,
most
whether it's
liberal
on Israel.
FDR, LBJ, you name it?
I think so. I think, you know, certainly we have to evaluate every president in their era. And FDR made a break with the past and was certainly now the great lion of the liberal movement. But in his own way, I think Barack Obama is as liberal in his era as FDR was in his. So if you like that, that's a good thing. If you don't like that, then he is a threat to the free market system, and he's imperiling national security. That's what elections are about, and that's the argument that's going to be. I think there was great amazement, frankly, in the conservative movement that Obama did not try to govern more from the center, and there was a great fear that the Republicans were going to be marginalized. He didn't do that, and liberals may like that, but I think it's given the Republicans an opportunity to put together this coalition, a right-center coalition, and you see this in the polls with independents drifting into the Republican camp. You see it in the generic polling numbers. And there's an opportunity for Republicans.
Maybe.
They better come up with a candidate who can sell himself to that independent and conservative bloc. But there's certainly a lot of political territory to be had.
Bart Stupak retiring in the news this week after the big blow-up on that front. Michael, do you see a winning strategy with Gingrich here with the most radical charge and secular socialist? In a word, Michael, we're almost out of time.
No, in a word, I see theatricality. Theatricality. I don't think it's a winning strategy. I think it's self-defeatingly hyperbolic, and I think that it riles up a base of voters, but a small segment, and I don't think that's where the election's going to be won or lost.
Will he join?
And as a closing thought, I would just say that Obama, who increased our troop presence in Afghanistan, is carrying out what you could call extrajudicial killings in Pakistan and is not going to rush to leave Iraq.
Michael, we've got it. Michael Crowley, Jennifer Rubin, Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.